Greetings, everybody. Helen, Sila, Lumen, Lumen, Tielbo. I am Loremaster Istiandur, and I am honored to be representing the Rangers of the West and to join you here in this lovely lore hall. Tonight is our kin's second time hosting this event, and we are delighted to have Dr. Corey Olson back on Gladden. Rangers of the West is a kin with players of sundry experience levels and varied interest in the game. Whether you are new to Gladden, a returning veteran, or even just rolling a new character, we'd be happy to have you join us and add to all our fun. And if you ever see us out and about in a group, please feel welcome to ask to join us just for the event. We are happy to get to know friends and other kins, too. I hope you enjoyed tonight's lecture, and I'd like to give a big thank you to Professor Narnian and Signum Yu for continuing this great series and coming back to Gladden. Almari Elden.
Thank you. Oh, okay, there we go. I was in the wrong place. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, guys, for having me. Good to be back here on Gladden and see lots of familiar and friendly faces here. Okay, let's see. I want to make sure... not run into more technical difficulties here. No, I think we're going. Sometimes if anyone's not hearing the stream right now, often what you need to do is refresh your screen. I think it's running. So I think we're good. But hey everybody, welcome back. So I am delighted to be back again on Gladden, and not only just to be back on Gladden, but of course to be back with you again doing Exploring the Lord of the Rings. I was of course, I've been away for the last 2 weeks. I've been traveling with my family first, and then on business out to Indianapolis. So I've been all over the place, south and east and west and all over. So, but I'm back now. Glad to be back in the place where the internet works and all that kind of thing. And excited to be digging back into Chapter 4 with you. Chapter 4, of course, is quite short. It's like half the length of Chapter 3, so we're probably not going to spend more than 3-4 classes in it, I'd think. But anyway, all right, so a couple quick things before we get started. First, quick announcement. Tomorrow is a pretty exciting thing. So we're starting a new Mythgard Academy class. The Mythgard Academy, in case you don't know, is a series that we've been doing now for almost 4 years, where people elected by, there's a popular election for the books that we study. We read through books together carefully and discuss them, kind of like I'm doing at the Lord of the Rings, a little bit less leisurely than I'm doing at the Lord of the Rings. Sometimes not all that much less, but a bit less. And we've been doing, of course, our History of Middle-earth series, where we've been going through the entire History of Middle-earth set, edited by Christopher Tolkien. We're going to continue that with The Treason of Isengard, but that's not what we're starting tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're starting a book that we've been waiting for, that I've been waiting to talk about for a really long time. And that is, we're doing The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius. It's the first medieval book that has won the Mythgard Academy election. Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy might not sound like a rollicking good time, but it's a really, really great book and a really important book, what's more, for understanding Tolkien. Tolkien was deeply influenced by Boethius. Well, okay, all of Western thought is really influenced by Boethius. And I think that there will be a lot of points that you'll see, where you'll see you'll be reminded of Tolkien as we're going through The Consolation of Philosophy. So I strongly recommend it. Wonderful opportunity to dig into this book together. So The Consolation of Philosophy, it was written in Latin, of course, the turn of the 6th century. I'm going to be using the Dover Publications edition, translated by Richard Green. There's also a perfectly decent public domain translation available, so you can use that as well from Project Gutenberg, which is also on LibriVox. So Anyway, it's going to be awesome. I'm super excited. So we're starting that tomorrow, Wednesday night, May 10th, 9:30 p.m. You can tune in right here on our Twitch channel. I simulcast it on our Twitch channel, so you can do that. It's going to be awesome. So, all right. So that's tomorrow night, and tonight we're digging back into Chapter 4. So, like 8 years ago when we last had class, we left the at least you have to acknowledge that we left our protagonists in a pretty good spot, right? We left Frodo and Sam and Pippin getting rather tipsy on elf liquor, sitting under a tree on the edge of the Marish, right? So they've been having a jolly time for the last 3 weeks while we've been going about our business, and we're going to pick up with them tonight. What I want to be really looking at is I want to be thinking about the way in which... there are a lot of juxtapositions, I think, in Chapter 4. You know, juxtaposition is a really fun word, which I enjoy saying whenever I can. That is, you know, when things are really kind of put next to each other... in a way that makes us really think about both of them differently. The contrast between the encounter with the elves and the encounter with the Black Rider, for instance. The difference in how Frodo thinks about the Black Riders after he has met with the elves and talked to Gildor, compared to what he was thinking and how he responded before. And then especially their experience running from the Black Riders through the Marish at the beginning of Chapter 4, which we're going to look at tonight, and then when they sort of cross the boundary and they enter Bam Furlong, they enter Farmer Maggot's land, and be thinking about that. So, anyway, I'm gonna be really interested to kind of dig into some of these things. I am expecting to get all the way to Farmer Maggot today, so it should be good. Okay, so let me. So our title today of Woodland Phantoms and Mushrooms. One of those contrasts, right? As we leave the scary woods full of scary things behind, and we enter the domesticated land. With tasty mushrooms, especially cooked with bacon. I only have one question that I wanted to address today. There are a bunch of really interesting comments and questions on the discussion board, which is again lotro.mythgard.org. But if you wanted to check, like in particular, I responded to a couple of them at length. There was some sort of general. Question about the sort of the general background of Angmar that we were talking about for a little while, but also I was engaging with a couple people where we were talking about I think I gave a little version of my rant about relatability in literature and books being relatable and why I kind of get annoyed by that. And I was sort of countered by Dr. Samuel Johnson, which is a pretty good way to counter somebody. But I'm a big fan of Dr. J. I love Samuel Johnson. And so I kind of talked about that a little bit. I said in my post, I don't want to get into it in class or I'm going to lose like 45 minutes. But, anyway, yeah. So, good. Anyhow, so yeah, so we'll do that. You can look that up, but I'm not going to do that today. The main one that I wanted to focus on here today was the question that Lady Shmebulak asked about Sam, the sort of the observations you made about Sam and kind of generalizing to Hobbit culture in general, because this was not only an interesting question, but actually leads us pretty directly into some of the stuff I want to get to tonight, especially as we get closer to Farmer Maggot. She says, in my mind, Sam has always been very thoughtful and a deeper thinker than many would see on the surface. I've only given a part of her post. She was talking also about how Sam often is depicted, like, for instance, in the Bakshi film especially, as, you know, the sort of bumbling idiot, which I agree with you. He totally is, and it's absolutely sort of missing the point, not just because it's making Sam look like a buffoon, which he should not be a buffoon, but I agree with you. It does an injustice even just to his intelligence. He clearly is a lot. He's not just a bumpkin in that way. I mean, he is a bumpkin, but he's not an idiot. Anyway, okay, let me carry on with your post here. Usually I think we look at Frodo or Bilbo as the greater minds of the Shire, with their adventures broadening their scope of mind. Sam, up until this point, hasn't traveled far, but his imagination always lay beyond the borders of his homeland, and it has been fueled by hearing Bilbo's stories and learning his letters. From what I gather, with the gaffer's caution of Sam's learning, most hobbits of his social class are not literate, either by choice or lack of opportunity. Does Hobbiton have a schoolhouse? I've always wondered. By the way, pause there. I don't think so. I'd be pretty surprised, actually, if Hobbiton had a schoolhouse. Maybe it does, but there's no reference to it. And that would seem to me odd, frankly. One thing that I would say, I don't want to get too distracted by this subtopic of the question, but it is an interesting one. Literacy. The importance of literacy as a mark of intelligence or even of culture, is a post-printing press phenomenon. Before the printing press, you don't need to be literate to be intelligent or even educated. There were lots of educated people who weren't literate. Very, very intelligent. There were lots of people who could, compose and translate from one language to another, but weren't literate. You don't need to be. That's a specialized skill. When there's no printing press, right? When it's not possible to very widely promulgate and reproduce printing, writing, you can get along with it. It's not a major thing. It was a much more oral culture, even not just in the earlier Middle Ages, but even in the later Middle Ages, for instance, it was still mostly an oral culture. You can be artistic, you can be, creative, you can be a poet without being literate necessarily. So it's something that I would, it's a misconception when projected backwards, because again, in our world, right, you can't get very far if you're not literate, right? I mean, being illiterate closes a lot of doors to you because there's print everywhere. Right. I mean, you can barely go down the street without, being able to read street signs and things. That's not an issue. Right. There was not illiteracy did not pose any obstacles to daily life. Again, as I said, it doesn't even propose that as many obstacles to a refined intellectual life in the Middle Ages as it does in the modern world. So. Again, I would be careful not to sort of color the gaffer's comments, for instance. The gaffer's, I agree with you, his clear resistance to learning, his concern that trouble might come of it, right? Because again, why? Why be literate, right? Why read? What's the point of reading? What good can reading do you, right? Again, think about, there's lots of ways we'd answer that question today, right? But a lot of those ways aren't even really relevant. Again, the answer, to read books, no, that's not really necessary, right? I mean, you only need one person in a household to be able to read the book, and everybody can enjoy the book, right? That's what usually happened. So again, just because someone's illiterate doesn't mean they're uncultured or not well-read, right? They may be very well, very familiar and a great lover of stories and poetry. And the kind of poetry that Sam clearly loves, he would not have had to be literate in order to enjoy. Anyway, so it's a general caution that I would issue. About sort of projecting modern assumptions about literacy and illiteracy backwards. And I think the Shire in this way is more medieval than, people often talk about the Shire being basically Victorian, kinda, but there are some big differences between the Shire and Victorian culture and in my opinion, the biggest one is the printing press. There's no printing presses in the Shire. And therefore, it's not primarily a literate culture. Tolkien says that, you know, by no means were all hobbits literate. There are some, there is a literate culture in the Shire, right? They do like to write letters to each other. They do write books and read books, right? Especially books that lay facts out very clearly and obviously with no contradictions, right? So we know that there is a literate sort of subculture in the Shire. But it's not necessarily a dominant culture, and it's clear at the social level of the Gamgees, it's not only not normal, but it's actively strange to be literate. And I love the way the gaffer puts it, right? That he hopes no harm will come of it, right? It's just not saying it's a bad thing. It's not clear what good can come of it, but some harm might come of it, right? It could distract. I mean, he could end up, you know, becoming all scribal, right? I mean, he could become all bookish, which is not really relevant for a gardener, right? More time spent reading means less time doing your proper work, right? Anyway, so I would just be cautious about that. So, no, I don't think that Hobbiton generally has a schoolhouse. The concept of public education in that sense, you know, sort of broad education, not really a thing. Okay, I know that this can be a factor in having a more narrow mindset towards the world around you, yes. But other Hobbits in higher social classes who would have access to more schooling, like Bilbo and Frodo, also have the same narrow mindset of the world, at least initially. Yes, I agree with you. It would seem to me that Hobbits either have a willful, shallow ignorance, or due to lack of learning, that's all they know. Hobbits who go outside the Shire come back with a broader view and think deeper of the ways and happenings of the world. I agree, this is a major factor, and this is where we get into the theme that is one of the things I really want to be looking at carefully today, in today's passages, especially, as I say, with Farmer Maggot, because this is, to me, one of the major issues, right? It's one of the things that becomes clearer and clearer as we are traveling across the Shire, right? As we, like, you know, sort of following along with Sam, it's not that we, especially if we've read The Hobbit before, right? It's not that we have never left, have never gone more than 20 miles away from Hobbiton, but you know, we get to go along with them as sort of this new world is opening up. For Sam, all of it's new, right? He's never even been past the Woody End before, but even, of course, for the others, right? Even for Frodo and for Pippin, new worlds are opening up to them, right? In their encounter with the elves, in their encounter with the Black Riders, right? All of a sudden, now they can fence themselves in, as Gildor tells them, but they can't forever fence the world out, and the world, that outer world, is coming in. They're encountering it. Most of the hobbits still oblivious to it, right? Even people like the gaffer who have met the Black Riders aren't really encountering the wider world or thinking about it much, right? But they now are, and they're thinking about it differently. So they already are starting to become broadened. But to me, it's less about education, and it's more about what Gildor is pointing to, I think, in the conversation there. Again, they think about shutting the world away, right? This is their Shire. They want to mind their own business, and they, you know, they don't want any part of the outside world. Like, you know, we don't need any big people here. We don't, you know, the dwarves can pass through, I guess, it's fine, but you know, we're just kind of doing our own thing, and we want to be left alone, right? That's kind of or even, of course, it's gotten to the point where they're so shut in, the hobbits, that they almost forget that there is an outside world, right? They're not even really very interested in it at all. Frodo is the only one, we're told, who's going around seeking news of the outside world, remember, at the beginning of Chapter 2. But again, the way that Gildor characterizes this is not as we have put up walls in order to protect ourselves from the outside world. He characterizes it as fencing themselves in, right? They have sheltered themselves, right? They have shut themselves away. They have turned their backs on the outside world and are facing only inward, towards the Shire, as if the Shire were the entire world. And as a result, they're sheltered, right? They're narrow. They do have a narrow mindset of the world. This is why one of the things that I would say that we can see most clearly, right? Hobbits who have been outside the Shire, hobbits who have been traveling, you know, the four travelers when they return at the end of the Return of the King, right? The difference between the cultural difference between the Shire, the Hobbits of Hobbiton, right, and the Hobbits of Buckland, really kind of begins to pale compared to the differences between the Shire and Rivendell and Gondor and Rohan and everywhere else they've been to, right? The world is just a bigger place. They're seeing things in a very different context than they've seen things. Than like Sam used to see things when all he knew was Hobbiton. And from that point of view, if all you know is Hobbiton, then, I mean, yeah, Buckland is way out there, right? And we'll see the same sort of thing in reverse from Farmer Maggot, right? To those who don't travel, anything very far away must be really strange. So again, they have no perspective, right? The thing that I want you to remember, the passage I want you to remember, which again, we'll come back to in a bit, is when Frodo confessed to Gandalf that he sometimes thought the residents of the Shire too stupid and dull for words, right? And thought that an invasion of dragons might be good for them. Remember that? And then he said he didn't feel that way now, right? And that he was glad that the Shire was there safe and comfortable and all that stuff. So that's great. But I think that the insight that he has is still an important one. And I think we're going to come back to that. We'll see Frodo himself kind of confronting, in a sense, that idea in chapter 4 here today. There's more that could be said about this stuff, but again, it's that sheltering, it's that perspective on the world, it's that circumscription of the world, right? That to me makes the real difference. And it's the fact that almost all of the hobbits in the Shire are like that, right? Their horizons are very narrow. And therefore their view of the world is challenged, right? Is not really broad enough. Okay. So let's, Ambrosius, Aurelianus, I'll answer your question, and then we're totally moving on, digging into the text here. It says, a friend had asked, how do the immortal elves view literature? Surely they love language and invented the written word, but with their immortality and strong memories, they really don't have the same need to record things that mortals do. No, they're not big into books, actually. Elves are not great book writers for exactly that reason. If you have memory, why do you need books? Right? Books are primarily for handing down to people after you die, right? I mean, of course, again, in a printing press world, books are for distributing widely, right? But not in a pre-printing press world, right? In a pre-printing press world, it's not about mass production and the promulgation of knowledge or something like that. In a pre-printing press world, books are about preservation. Like, let's write stuff down so it doesn't get forgotten. But yeah, the immortals, not so interested in this. It's true that, you know, they did things like invent alphabets and scripts and things like that, but no, they were not much into written literature at all. For exactly that reason. Okay. Let's dig into the text here. So we're back to the songs. This is where we finished last time. I sort of tantalized you with the drinking song, and then we had to stop and take several weeks off. So let's look at this. Frodo propped his back against the tree trunk and closed his eyes. Sam and Pippin sat near, and they began to hum and then to sing softly. Ho, 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 to the bottle I go, to heal my heart and drown my woe. Rain may fall and wind may blow, and many miles be still to go. But under a tall tree I will lie, and let the clouds go sailing by. Okay, first of all, notice the shape of the song, right? Hobbit meter, again, iambic tetrameter, right? Notice how regular it is, to heal my heart and drown my woe. That is like perfect iambic tetrameter, right? In fact, the whole thing is really regular. This is not there's almost no complicated rhythms in this song. The only line that kind of changes things up, there are only really two lines that change things up significantly, and many miles be still to go has a different rhythm, right?
And the first one, ho, 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 right? Where we start off with the three presumably equally stressed hoes, right? Ho, 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 to the bottle I go. But once that kind of revs things up, right? Once the rhythm gets going after that, it becomes really, really regular. It's a very simple rhythm. Not a lot of sort of personality in these lines. I kind of like the fact that the one place where the rhythm kind of stumbles, right, is the reference to the many miles be still to go. Right? I mean, there's a sense, right? That's what's being avoided in this song, right? The song is the perfect song for the occasion, right? Because the content and context of the song fit perfectly. They are in fact lying under a tall tree with their elf booze, right? While there are in fact many miles still to go, and they really should be moving along, but you know, they're going to stop for a little heart healing and woe drowning, right, before they move on. That's kind of a slightly uncomfortable reminder, right, that there are many miles still to go. But then we kind of get back into the rhythm, right? But under a tall tree I will lie and let the clouds go sailing by. Right? That's a much, much smoother sailing in those last two lines, right, than in line four. And yes, Tony Mead, I agree. The other factor of the simplicity of the verse, it's clearly designed to be sung with others, right? One person could sing this once and then everybody could join in the second time, right? It's not designed to be complex. There is no complex wordplay, right? You know, there's no complex rhythms, as I said. It's very simple. And yes, Milthaliel says it sounds like it'd be easy to remember the words even when drunk. Yes, it does certainly sound that way. Good. Now, let's see, what else was I going to say about this? I like the fact, thinking of those two middle lines, right? When you think about the sort of the shape of it, not thinking of the sound of the lines now, but thinking of the content of the lines. When you look at the shape of it, it's sort of like three sets of two lines, right? And this of course fits because it's in rhyming couplets, right? So that sort of works, even though notice the first, the rhyme shape is more complicated than, now I'm digressing. I was going to talk about the content, but hang on, let's talk about the rhyme for a second. Notice that the rhyme shape is a little more interesting than that, right? At first it sounds like rhyming couplets, but it's not just rhyming couplets, because the first four lines all have the same rhyme. And indeed, it's not just that the first four lines all have the same rhyme, but lines one and four are on the same word even. Right, which is a kind of an interesting frame to that first quatrain. So the rhyme would seem to break the lines up into four and two, right? Ho, 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 to the bottle I go, to heal my heart and drown my woe. Rain may fall and wind may blow, and many miles be still to go. But under a tall tree I will lie and let the clouds go sailing by. Right, so that the different rhyme when it emerges in those last two lines, right, indicates like this sort of shift in action right there. But really the content to me goes two lines at a time, right? The first two lines are declaring the intention, right? I'm headed to the bottle, right? And I'll tell you why, right? I got two reasons, to heal my heart and to drown my woe, right? There we go, to the bottle. And then the second two lines, right, lines three and four, talk about the circumstances, right? I don't care what happens, right? The rain can fall and the wind can blow, right? So we're talking about external circumstances, right? Things can change around me. Bad stuff can start happening. I don't care, right? There may be many miles still in front of me, right? So bad things might come to me in the present. There's still labors and difficulties in the future. Don't care, right? In the present, what's going to happen, or my present declaration of my intention, it is still declaring what's going to happen in the immediate future, right? Under a tall tree, I will lie and let the clouds go sailing by. So again, those three couplets all really kind of seem to speak fairly sequentially. JJ48, I agree with you. He does sound awfully cheerful about drowning his woe, right? I agree. This isn't exactly like a major. Doesn't sound like a major complaint, right? It is kind of like a Hobbit version of the blues, but it's pretty mild blues, right? You know, this isn't like, one of those songs about like how his wife left him and somebody just ran over his dog, right? This is, you know, he acknowledges the fact that there's woe in the picture, but we don't hear anything about the woe in the picture, right? All we hear about is the labor, the travel that he may or may not be shirking, right? availing himself of the bottle. Yes. Yeah. I agree. So Baron's hand said it's as bluesy as a Hobbit gets. Yeah, I guess so. That doesn't really seem to be the kind of thing that they do, but I guess perhaps in Hobbit by Hobbit standards. But notice the overall spirit of this, right? I mean, those first two lines could sound kind of ominous, right? I mean, like it's, that is to say, if presented in a certain spirit, again, that could sound like it's time for an intervention, right? But the spirit of the whole poem certainly sounds like it's cheerful, right? The healing and drowning in the bottle is being done in a more or less in a cheerful, upbeat, friendly fashion. Not an actual like I'm going to drink myself into insensibility in order to drown out my sorrows. That is to say, at the end of the day, it's about friendship, community, good spirits among friends. It's the kind of drinking that we're talking about. And here I come back to some of the observations we were making about the shape of it, the rhythm of it, the simplicity of it. It's clearly meant to be sung together, and that's what we see, right? They hum and then they sing together, and then they begin to come back around and sing it louder. Like you do when you've been drinking, right? So that's clearly the sort of the overall atmosphere that we get here. This sort of cheerful obliviousness, this decision to set aside anxiety and concern and everything else, right? And just sort of enjoy the moment and all that. Okay. Now look what happens. Ho, 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 they began again louder. They stopped short suddenly. Frodo sprang to his feet. A long-drawn wail came down the wind, like the cry of some evil and lonely creature. It rose and fell and ended on a high, piercing note. Even as they sat and stood, as if suddenly frozen, it was answered by another cry, fainter and further off, but no less chilling to the blood. There was then a silence, broken only by the sound of the wind in the leaves. Something that I think we have to emphasize about this passage that I think is super clear. And again, I'm not trying to like harsh on the movies or something. The Nazgul don't sound anything like they sound in the movies. Notice the description of the sound of the cry that the Nazgul make. Again, not trying to diss on the Peter Jackson films. I love the Nazgul shriek in the films. It's really effective. It's really great. When I was doing on Twitter, I was doing a poll before I left for vacation of what the collective noun for Nazgul should be. I think we decided on Scourge. Didn't we decide on Scourge? Several people were suggesting a shriek of Nazgul, and I didn't get into it in Twitter. But I didn't like that one. And the reason I didn't like that one is because Nazgul don't actually shriek. It's not a thing they do. They shriek in the films, but they don't shriek. They wail. And notice what information we get about the cry of the Nazgul that we hear. It's a long drawn wail, right? It lasts for a long time. This is not just a cry, right? There's feeling in it, right? The cry of some evil and lonely creature. It rises and falls, right? It modulates. It's not just a note. It's not a whistle. It's not a shriek. And yes, Stephanie, exactly. Stephanie says wail and cry indicates a voice. That's the thing. That's the important thing. It's not a shriek. It's not a whistle. This is a voice speaking. And it's communication. There's communication happening here, right? Because it's answered by another cry, fainter and further off. Now, the first emphasis here is on the impact that it has on them, right? On the hobbits who hear it. It's chilling to the blood. It sounds like the cry of an evil and lonely creature. The evilness of it, right, is something that strikes them and seems to be connected with the chilling, right? But also lonely, right? It's not only evil, but it's also lonely. It seems to excite, therefore, both sort of apprehension, right? They're creeped out by it. But they also seem to have pity raised by this, right? That's what I get. Pity is what I hear in the emphasis of lonely, right? And let's look at the follow-up. "And what do you think that was?" Pippin asked at last, trying to speak lightly, but quavering a little. "If it was a bird, it was one that I never heard in the Shire before." "It was not bird or beast," said Frodo. "It was a call or a signal. There were words in that cry, though I could not catch them. But no hobbit has such a voice." No more was said about it. They were all thinking of the riders, but no one spoke of them. They were now reluctant either to stay or go on. But sooner or later they had to get across the open country to the ferry, and it was best to go sooner and in daylight. In a few moments they had shouldered their packs again and were off. Dime, when I say pity, I don't mean that they're like, oh, the poor ringwraiths, right? But if you hear a cry, right, in the wild, and your response is, sounds lonely, right? To me, that seems like, you know, at least an echo of something like pity, right? That it's not just fear that they feel. It's sort of acknowledgement of like, wow, like I wouldn't want to be whoever that was that's crying out there. But there are words in the cry. So let's try to picture this, right? Frodo can hear words in the cry, but it's a long drawn wail. And it's rising and falling and ending on a high, piercing note. That's why I called this. I put two songs on this slide. It's a song, right? I mean, it's a long, sustained vocalization that has words in it, i.e., it's a song, and JJ48 says, maybe this is the Nazgul version of the blues. Maybe it is, right? Exactly. See, JJ, now that's a little more bluesy, right? I'm evil, and I'm lonely, and I'm in the Marish, far from home, right? That's a little bit more bluesy, right? I can totally get into that. I agree. Grim Dragon says it's a sound that's difficult to imagine, almost like trying to imagine a color you've never seen before. It invokes emotions you've never felt. Yes. I agree. But it's definitely, so Frodo can tell, he says it's a signal, right? There's communication going on between the two of them. So in other words, we get the communal song, right, among the hobbits, this happy, cheerful, sort of carpe diem drinking song that they were just singing. And then we get the evil, lonely, chilling cry, a signal sent from one to the other, this other song. Bad guys sing, right? And when bad guys sing, it's bad news often, right? I mean, ask Finrod Felagund, right, about that, who lost a singing competition with Sauron back in the First Age. Anyway, yeah. So there's I think a really interesting so again, this is the first of those juxtapositions that I was talking about, right? This beautiful little happy, very hobbit-like moment, right? Sitting under a tree, you know, in high spirits in more than one sense, right? And or you know, I guess in good spirits in more than one sense. And then the evil, lonely cry of the Nazgul singing back and forth to each other. Yeah, Matt, it sounds like that to me too. Matt says it almost seems to describe something like a medieval religious chant. Yes, the rising and the falling and the ending on a high note. Yeah. I agree. It sounds that way to me too. Yeah. You know, we're not going to get any singing competitions with the Ringwraiths exactly, right? We'll get some conflicts of will, right? But not directly conflicts of song, right? So, okay. Keep this passage in mind, right? And it's one of the reasons I really wanted to emphasize this and why I think this juxtaposition is so interesting. We're not going to come back to the drinking song very often, right? We're not going to allude to it over the rest of the story, but we are going to allude to this sound that they hear, the Nazgul cry that they hear. Almost every time the Nazgul are heard crying in the distance, we hear the wail of the Nazgul in the distance, the narrator is going to remind us of this moment, just like they heard in the Marish, right? Back before. There will be a number of references. If you have The Lord of the Rings on ebook, do a search for the word Marish, right? And you'll find it, right? The number of times that keeps getting alluded to all the way through into The Return of the King. We're still going to be recalling the first time. You know, it's almost like one of those flashbulb memories, right? Whenever they hear the Nazgul, it's like you remember where you were the first time you heard it, right? That's the way that the narrator refers back to it reminds me of that, right? They'll always remember this moment. This is a serious and important moment for them. And I think it's no coincidence that it does come after their encounter with the elves, right? You'd think that for Frodo, seeing the Black Rider like get off his horse and crawling across the ground, snuffling and sniffing towards him in the dark, would have been like the most creepy moment with the Ringwraiths. But no, after the conversation with Gildor, and now he hears this song and this cry with words in it, this, you know, evil, lonely thing. This seems to be the thing that really kind of crystallizes his experience with the Ringwraiths. Okay. So look, as a bonus, we already talked about this too. And I love the reference, but no hobbit has such a voice, right? That was definitely not a hobbit. Notice how that, you know, and I love Pippin's attempt at lightheartedness, right? What do you think that was, right? Bird, you think? Think that was a bird? He's trying for hobbit lightheartedness, right? That's what they do when things are spooky. They make jokes. They try to keep it light. Frodo can't be light about this, right? But notice how he doesn't name the Black Riders, right? He points to them pretty clearly, but he doesn't say it, right? They don't say it. They're all thinking it, but nobody speaks of it. And the result, they're reluctant either to stay or go on. Mithalia, remember the point that you made about Gildor's words last time. Remember at the beginning of class, we talked about Mithalia's point about how she had always been frustrated with Gildor for not saying anymore. And Frodo saying, I can't imagine what would be more terrifying than your hints and warnings, right? I can't imagine what information would be more terrifying than your hints and warnings. But I really liked Mithalia's very interesting point that actually you can kind of see when you look back through the rest of book one, and you can see actually maybe if he'd known more, he wouldn't have been able to do what he was doing. Notice Mithalia, the effect setting in right here, right? What is the consequence? of this confrontation with the Black Riders, right? Or this sort of, I don't mean confrontation face to face, right? But this confrontation of like the reality of the Black Riders is paralysis, Malfalio, right? They don't want to, like if they were to take off running, that would be something, right? That would be panic. That would not be great, but it would be kind of potentially productive if they ran the right way, right? The result is absolute paralysis. They're terrified to stay. They're terrified to go. The whole world transforms around them. Remember where they were singing under the tree just a minute ago. And now everything is a threat, right? They're terrified of the woods because the Black Riders are near. They're terrified of the open country because the Black Riders could see them. They don't know what to do. So if they actually did know more, right? You know, if on top of the experience of hearing this cry, and I wonder if they're actually affected by the song, right? Remember how the Song of the Elves imprinted itself on their minds, right? They were able to translate it even though, you know, they didn't really know the language. You know, Frodo knows some of the language, but Pippin and Sam don't, right? But it formed itself in their minds, right? It kind of seems to me that the Song of the Nazgul has kind of formed itself in their minds to some extent as well, right? Both the impression, like the evil and loneliness thing, but also their reaction, right? They have been enchanted, I think, in a sense, right? In a very different way, obviously, than they were enchanted by the elves. And the result is just terror, right? Dread, exactly. And Urstarg, I assume you're making a reference to the gameplay mechanism in Lotro, the dread mechanism. For those of you who don't play the game, I can show you on this the ring around the mini map here will sometimes be glowing blue and sometimes be glowing red. And you can see my hope is at zero right now. I feel neither hope nor dread. I love the fact that Lotro, this is one of the most complex, sort of abstract elements of Tolkien's world. And I love the fact that they incorporated that into the gameplay in Lotro. I never expected something like that, where, if you're near a Nazgul, for instance, if you're experiencing that kind of horror, that kind of despair that comes over people when in the presence of the Balrog or in the presence of the Nazgul, then you're affected by dread and it reduces your morale, it makes you weaker, right? And sometimes it paralyzes you entirely. Or if you're like in Lorien or if you're in Rivendell or something, your hope goes up and your hope is higher and you're stronger. And I love it. I just love that effect that they tried to capture the hope versus dread element in Tolkien's work. Totally hats off of all of the pure gameplay elements, not the characters, the storylines or the artistic design or the visuals, anything like that, but the game mechanics in Lotro, the hope and dread thing is the thing that most impresses me. So they're paralyzed, but they pull it together and they go off. Now look at what happens. Remember the description of their walking before, right? Remember in chapter 3. Spent a lot of time walking together in chapter 3. Spent a lot of time looking at the countryside around, right? Getting descriptions of the countryside around. Walking side by side and in step and breaking into walking songs and things like that, right? Look now at their walking. And look at the description of the countryside around them now. Before long, the wood came to a sudden end. Wide grasslands stretched before them. They now saw that they had, in fact, turned too much to the south. Away over the flats they could glimpse the low hill of Buckleberry across the river, and it was now to their left. Creeping cautiously out from the edge of the trees, they set off across the open as quickly as they could. At first they felt afraid, away from the shelter of the wood. Far back behind them stood the high place where they had breakfasted. Frodo half expected to see the small distant figure of a horseman on the ridge, dark against the sky, but there was no sign of one. The sun escaping from the breaking clouds, as it sank towards the hills they had left, was now shining brightly again. Their fear left them, though they still felt uneasy. But the land became steadily more tame and well-ordered. Soon they came into well-tended fields and meadows. There were hedges and gates and dikes for drainage. Everything seemed quiet and peaceful, just an ordinary corner of the shire. Their spirits rose with every step. The line of the river grew nearer, and the black riders began to seem like phantoms of the woods, now left far behind. That last sentence, of course, is where I took the title from the class. Notice, again, the contrasts here. When we start off here, as I suggested in my subtitle here, this is no Hobbit walking party anymore, right? Not even Pippin is just having a good time larking around the Shire anymore, right? Look at they're creeping cautiously out from the edge of the trees, right? They're looking over their shoulder, thinking about where they breakfasted. They look back at, where did they breakfast? At Woodhall, right? At the elf glade, in the elf spot. He looks back at it, right? And instead of being like, good times, right? Happy memories, right? I remember the elves. We were right there with the elves. No, he looks back at the place where the elves were and expects to see a black rider there, right? Or at least half expects to see that, right? Remember, Gildor said, you can fence yourselves in, and earlier on we were emphasizing the significance of the fencing themselves in, right? But you cannot forever fence it out, fence the wide world out, right? The wide world has invaded the Shire, and they are feeling it now. The whole Shire feels different. Those forests that they're leaving behind were very cheerful forests yesterday, right? They're... wasn't any problem. Now everything looks different. Even again, looking back at the memory of their time with the elves now seems different. It's now been in that, like, imaginatively overtaken by their encounter with the Black Riders, right? Again, remember Frodo half expecting to see Black Riders having physically taken the place of the elves, right? Where the elves were looking, you know, where they were looking out with the elves, now the Black Rider is going to be spying on them from that spot, right? Okay. But then their spirits rise, right? And what is it that makes their spirit rise? The land becoming steadily more tame and well-ordered. They're returning to the normal Shire, right? It's hard for them to continue to feel the same way, right? It's one thing to be, like, they were enjoying their Hobbit walking party, and the Hobbit walking party got kind of wrecked by the, you know, the whole Nazgul thing was a bit of a damper on that, right? But it's like coming back to the real world, right? Harder to believe in these, you know, spirits from the outside world, right? These phantoms of the woods. You know, we've left them. We've left them far behind, right? And you're right, Stephanie, that we can see that their tendency to be lighthearted and hopeful is still emerging, right? Despite the Black Riders and the fear of the Black Riders. Miltholiel, it is almost like leaving Faerie and coming back to the normal mundane world, right? I do think that's part of it, Miltholiel. It's not like, well, surely the Black Rider, I don't think that their comfort is rational here. That is, you know, it's not like the Black Riders would surely never dare to follow us to this spot, right? But rather it's like, it's harder to believe in them. And that's what we see in that last line. The Black Riders began to seem like phantoms of the woods, now left far behind. They've not been left. They're not phantoms of the woods, right? They're kind of phantomish, but they're not phantoms of the woods. They're not like, again, like evil local spirits, right? That when you go back, when you leave the dark, you know, the dark German forest in the Brothers Grimm, and you come back out to tilled farmland, you're now safe, right, from the dwarves and fairies and giants and ogres and witches that you might find in the forest. But that's how it feels to them, right? Went the wrong way. Okay. Now look what happens as they're approaching Farmer Maggot's house. The mood is rising, right? Their spirits are rising. They're feeling more confident and more relaxed. And the Black Riders are starting to feel more and more unreal, right? Returning to the normal wood, the normal world. And everything's getting nicer and more cheerful. And then there's this sudden reversal. I know these fields and this gate, Pippin says. This is Bem Furlong, old Farmer Maggot's land. That's his farm away there in the trees. One trouble after another, said Frodo, looking nearly as much alarmed as if Pippin had declared the lane was the slot leading to a dragon's den. The others looked at him in surprise. What's wrong with old Maggot? Asked Pippin. He's a good friend to all the Brandybucks. Of course he's a terror to trespassers, and he keeps ferocious dogs. But after all, folks are down here near the border and have to be more on their guard. I know, said Frodo. But all the same, he added with a shamefaced laugh, I'm terrified of him and his dogs. I've avoided his farm for years and years. He caught me several times trespassing after mushrooms when I was a youngster at Brandy Hall. On the last occasion he beat me, and then he took me and showed me to his dogs. See, lads, he said, next time this young varmint sets foot on my land, you can eat him. Now see him off. They chased me all the way to the ferry. I've never got over the fright, though I dare say the beasts knew their business and would not really have touched me. Again, everything seems to be moving in the positive direction. And then all of a sudden, the central element of that domesticated, tame, mundane, day-to-day agricultural shire that they're passing back into, civilized shire, right, that they're passing back into, the central element of that becomes something that raises fear in Frodo. And I love the association there. Right. Looking nearly as much alarmed as if Pippin had declared the lane was the slot leading to a dragon's den. Right. Farmer Maggot is like a dragon. That's like the picture Frodo has always had in his mind. Right. Farmer Maggot was his personal ogre. Like, Farmer Maggot was the boogeyman. He was the monster under the bed, right, when Frodo was a kid. This is the sort of the image of Farmer Maggot that he left Buckland with. Now, and of course, you're right. Who was that? Yeah, Oakwig is mentioning it, and JJ48 is saying, if Frodo, if you think this Farmer Maggot is bad, just be glad you're not meeting the one from the Return of the Shadow. And it's true, and, you know, thinking about that, just to, for those of you who didn't do the last Mythgard Academy class with me, and you still can, it's on YouTube, we went through the Return of the Shadow, the earliest drafts of the Fellowship of the Ring, Tolkien beginning to find his way and figure out the story of the Lord of the Rings. Fascinating to see. When he first gets to Farmer Maggot, he makes Farmer Maggot really nasty. He's not a literal ogre, right? He's still a hobbit, but he's awful. I mean, he, like, is absolutely terrible. Indeed, there's this one, like, version of the story that he wrote where Bilbo, you know, he relates a story where Bilbo is traveling with, Bingo, of course, is still his name. He's not Frodo yet. Bilbo's traveling with Bingo, and the dog almost kills them, and Bilbo kills Farmer Maggot's dog with his stick, and Farmer Maggot, like, tries to kill him, and Bilbo threatens to come back and challenge him to a duel with swords. And I mean, it's like, it's pretty intense. They're, like, actually threatening to kill each other. Farmer Maggot, what his first thought about Farmer Maggot was that Farmer Maggot really would be this, like, totally inhospitable, ogre-ish figure. That's not where he ends up with Farmer Maggot, right? But to me, remembering that is really interesting, again, thinking about this association that Frodo has between Farmer Maggot and dragons, right? And this is one of those places, Lady Shmebulak, where I want to come back to the comment that you were making about the widening perspective of travel, right? And the narrow perspective of most Shire hobbits. We can see this was true, has been true, is still true of Frodo, right? It's no great shock that in Frodo's little world, right, when he's a kid in Buckland, it's no surprise that Farmer Maggot is like the big bad of his world, right? And that's how he thinks of him. And he still retains that memory even now into his adulthood. He's a little bit ashamed of it, right? He's shamefaced as he's speaking of it, but he's still uneasy, right? He still doesn't trust him. He's still nervous, despite the fact that he now has sort of heard enough and knows enough to suspect maybe I don't have a real balanced view of Farmer Maggot, right? Based on my very few interactions with him when I was a kid. Okay, so think about the shift there, right? And remember Frodo's own words about how he thought that an invasion of dragons would be good for the Shire. Keep that in mind. It's, of course, the one where we see that come most relevant to is going to be Frodo himself. Through the gate there now appeared a broad, thick-set hobbit with a round, red face. "Hello, hello. And who may you be, and what may you be wanting?" he asked. "Good afternoon, Mr. Maggot," said Pippin. The farmer looked at him closely. "Well, if it isn't Master Pippin, Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say," he cried, changing from a scowl to a grin. "It's a long time since I saw you round here. It's lucky for you that I know you. I was just going out to set my dogs on any strangers. There are some funny things going on today. Of course, we do get queer folk wandering in these parts at times. Too near the river," he said, shaking his head. "But this fellow was the most outlandish I have ever set eyes on. He won't cross my land without leave a second time, not if I can stop it." "What fellow do you mean?" asked Pippin. "Then you haven't seen him?" said the farmer. "He went up the lane towards the causeway not a long while back. He was a funny customer and asking funny questions. But perhaps you'll come along inside and we'll pass the news more comfortable. I've a drop of good ale on tap, if you and your friend are willing, Mr. Took." Okay, several things to observe about Farmer Maggot's response here, about our first introduction to Farmer Maggot. One thing that I don't want to overlook. Notice what a close shave they've had, right? It's easy to miss this. This is one of those things that I didn't notice for years reading this passage. One of the things that we can take from this initial conversation with Farmer Maggot is they barely escaped the Black Rider, right? Notice the significance of his question, "Then you haven't seen him?" He's surprised that they haven't seen him. Why should he be surprised that they haven't seen him? Because you can't wander off the road. The road is on a causeway, right? That is to say, it's a raised dirt road above marshland, right? So you got marshland, but then you raise a causeway to have the road. There's nowhere to hide on a causeway, right? If you're on a causeway through a marsh, the only thing you can do is jump off into the swamp, which they obviously haven't done, right? Because they're not totally immersed in swamp water. So it's kind of a big deal. He assumes that they will have seen him, right? Because if they came down from the road and he just went up the lane and to the causeway, they had to have crossed, right? Given how close they came, you know, so their paths had to have crossed. Now, of course, it didn't, because they came cross country. Right, they came from the other direction over his fields, right? Instead of up the causeway, down the causeway from the main road, right, towards his lane. So it's very lucky that they didn't. So we already see they were right to choose the way that they chose, right? The shortcut caused a delay, yes. But if they hadn't chosen the shortcut, if they hadn't gone across country, they would have run into the Black Riders. Well, maybe, I guess. There's, of course, one other possibility. They wouldn't have run into the Black Rider if they'd stayed at the Golden Perch for long enough, right? They'd have missed him. But anyway, so maybe Pippin's route would have been just as good in the end. But anyhow, other things. Let's see, Tony Mead is asking, why is Farmer Maggot such a noteworthy person that all these hobbits from far away know him? Is it because of his large farm or location or what? Both of the last two, I would say. I mean, he's a fairly important, he's a substantial farmer. He's clearly a pretty important guy in the world of the Marish. And you know, the Marish is just across the river from Brandy Hall. It's clear that there's a lot of coming and goings. I mean, remember, his land is close enough that teenagers in Brandy Hall cross the river on the ferry and go to his fields for a lark and to stir up trouble, right? And to poach his mushrooms. So if you're going to dare your friend to go steal mushrooms from them, you know, like, obviously, it's you can see how close and convenient it is, right, to just go across the river and do that right there. So we can see that he's nearby. So therefore, the people of Brandy Hall know him. How does he know Pippin? I don't think this is a case necessarily of Pippin over in Tuckborough, right? Growing up in Tuckborough. I don't think that this is the case of Pippin having heard of Farmer Maggot from there, right? Like, everybody knows Farmer Maggot all the way across the Shire. No, Mary knows Farmer Maggot, right? Because Mary is an important person in Buckland. Farmer Maggot is one of the major people round about. So Mary knows Farmer Maggot, and Pippin is friends with Mary and has visited him a lot and been there quite a bit. So he has been introduced to him. You can tell that he's known him for a long time, right? How do we know that Farmer Maggot has known Pippin for a long time? We can see he's known him for many years, right? You see how we can know that? If it isn't Master Pippin, Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say, he says, right? Now, so remember, master means the word master is what is the title that you give to a boy, right? Exactly, Nathaniel. That's a childish name, right? The young master, right, is what somebody in the lower class would call a child who is in the upper class, right? He calls him Master Pippin. He still thinks of him as a kid, right? A teenager, you know, a hobbit lad running around with Mary Brandybuck, right? And then he corrects himself. Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say. Right, yes, a young man in short pants, Dime. Exactly. So he corrects himself. He's not Master Pippin anymore, right? He is now Mr. Peregrine Took, right? Even though he's not officially come of age, so he's probably actually not Mr. yet, right? Exactly. Veronica was just reminding us that he's not yet 33. Yeah, he's not come of age yet. So I actually think, Veronica, for that reason, I actually think that the Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say, is kind of giving Pippin a hard time, right? Technically, he's not Mr. Peregrine Took yet, right? He's still Pippin. But you know, this sort of show of respect, like, oh, excuse me, I mean Mr. Peregrine Took, right? But it's clear from their reaction, he is treating him with respect. That is, even the both the master and the mister, right, are ways of Farmer Maggot acknowledging Pippin's class, right? Notice that Pippin calls him Mr. Maggot, right? Acknowledging that he's a significant landowner, right? You know, he's entitled to be called Mr. Notice nobody calls Ted Sandyman Mr. Nobody calls Gaffer Gamgee Mr. Gamgee, right? Remember what Bilbo calls the gaffer? Master Hamfast. Karita, Alfred does call Batman Master Wayne. Yes, absolutely he does. Because, of course, Bruce Wayne is always the young master to Alfred. It happens when you're like 150 or however old Alfred is. He calls him Master Hamfast, right? He's not a kid, but he is a peasant. He's not Mr. He's not a landowner. Again, the title Mister had a meaning, right? It wasn't just the generic masculine thing, right? It meant like you own land to be called Mister. Those of you who've been doing the Mythgard Academy with me may remember the moment in Dracula where this came up, where the Honorable Arthur Holmwood, who became Lord Godalming when his father died, he became a peer, he inherited the title from his father. And you may remember, again, if you read Dracula with me, you may remember that moment when Van Helsing says, is having a problem knowing what to call Arthur because Arthur's father's just died, but that's an awkward subject and everything. And he says, I must not call you Mr. I can't call you Mr. Holmwood because you're a peer now, right? So I anyway, so he doesn't know what to call him, right? Because, but Mr. is not good enough, but he, anyway. And yes, you're right, Tony, the gaffer is also Bilbo's junior, right? The gaffer was the apprentice to Bilbo's original gardener, right? So it is kind of charming to think that there's a... so, Carita, there you go, right? Bilbo is to Ham Gamgee as Alfred is to Bruce Wayne, right? It's exactly like that. Anyway, okay. Good. Now, yes, Dime points out that Sam Gamgee is always introduced by his name. Yes, he's always called Sam or Sam Gamgee. He's not called Mr. Gamgee. Which is exactly, you'll notice the same thing with Ted Sandyman, right? He's always Ted Sandyman. He's never Mr. Sandyman. Or his father was not Mr. Sandyman. He was Old Sandyman the Miller, right? Same thing. Again, the title means something. Finn was saying, but Sam also calls Frodo Master. Yeah, that's the big, but notice he doesn't call him Master Frodo. He just calls him Master, right? If you just call somebody Master, you're acknowledging like he's the Master and you're the servant, so you call him Master, right? But that when that word is used as like a title before the name, it's what you call a kid, right? Or somebody junior to you, or somebody sort of, anyway. It's all really complicated, but there's lots of kind of interesting cues that we get from this. So we see they've known each other a long time. They have a very friendly relationship, right? We see them picking on each other, right? Farmer Maggot kind of giving Pippin a hard time there. What else do we see? We see the pluck of Farmer Maggot, right? Another thing that, a thing that Farmer Maggot and Ham Gamgee have in common, right? Telling black riders off, right? He had just determined he was going to sit his dogs on any black riders that came by again, right? Yeah, I mean, this is just, it's kind of a wonderful thing to think about Farmer Maggot doing this, right? And if I see any more, like, undead spirits on my land, I'm going to set my dogs on them, I will. You know, it's awesome, right? Just you got to love the cheekiness, just like, Ham Gamgee slamming his door in the face of a black rider. Pretty awesome. Notice a couple things in Farmer Maggot's perspective here as well. There are some funny things going on today. He says, of course, we do get queer folk wandering in these parts at times, right? Too near the river, he says, shaking his head. Right. It's interesting that it's almost like he's confessing that Ham Gamgee was right, that folk are queer over in Buckland. Right. He's like, yeah, things are queer around here. We're too close to the river. Right. But of course, he's not acknowledging that. Right. They are normal. Like the residents of the Marish are not queer. Right. It's the people from across the border, because you do get people from across the border, and those people can be pretty darn outlandish. Right. And sometimes they encounter them. So we see already a way in which the residents of the Marish, because they do encounter the outside world to some extent, right? And occasionally, at least, we do see ways in which they already have, in a sense, a kind of a broader, at least a slightly broader view of things than the hobbits of Hobbiton do, who are much more thoroughly sheltered because not so near the border. He won't cross my land without leave a second time. Not if I can stop it. Though I do like the sort of acknowledgement that he seems to make there, right? That is, he's not just blowing gas, right? He acknowledges there's at least the implicit acknowledgement that he might not be able to stop it, I think, right? But anyway, he won't cross my land without leave a second time is still a fairly confident thing. Oakwig is suggesting that Farmer Maggot's blues song would be titled Too Near the River. Anyway, okay. He's a funny customer, asking funny questions. Customer. Exactly the same word that both Ham Gamgee and Farmer Maggot used, even their dialect is very similar. Let's continue to look at Farmer Maggot as representative. This is one thing that I would really like to emphasize here too. Remember that shift from the wild wood, right? The fairy wood. As we were talking about before, the place where magical, strange, queer, evil, bizarre things have been happening, right? Good and evil, strange things have been happening, but they've all been strange in the woods, right? In the woody end of all places, right? I mean, just like a normal part of the Shire, but here it's been transformed by all these otherworldly things they've been meeting, right? As their world is changing, or rather their view of the world that they thought of as the quiet world, their own Shire, which Gildor says isn't your own Shire, and their eyes are being opened to that, right? But anyway, they've left that behind, right? And now they've passed into cultivated, normal, mundane Shire world. And in that world, Farmer Maggot is, I think, possibly the most representative hobbit that we meet. I mean, Gaffer Gamgee is pretty close too, but remember, almost all the hobbits we know are weird, right? Weird in a good way, but they're weird. Bilbo's weird, Frodo's weird. We're told they're weird, the exceptional is the word that the preface uses. They're weird even just because they aren't married, right? As bachelors, they're very exceptional. Most hobbits get married and have a family, right? Most hobbits are not landed gentry living in Bag End, right? Most hobbits are farmers living in a family, living in this communal existence and close to the land, right? That's Farmer Maggot's life. That's normal. That's much more mainstream hobbit than any of the companions, right? Merry and Pippin are like little princelings, right? The heirs of the two greatest families of the Shire, right? Frodo is even weirder, right? Because he has not only the wealth of Bilbo, right, handed down to him in Bag End, the house built by Bilbo's father, but he also has the heritage of weirdness, right? Being taught elvish and all these other things, right? Those outlandish notions, right, that Bilbo has been encouraging in his young nephew. So Frodo's even weirder. Sam's grown up under the influence, right? They're all kind of weird. None of them are truly mainstream hobbits. Farmer Maggot, totally mainstream hobbit. I agree with you, Mike. The Cottons are pretty typical as well, right? When we meet Farmer Coppin, we meet Farmer Cotton, we will get another example of like good, sturdy hobbitry, right? Your sort of mainstream hobbit, but we haven't got him yet, right? We don't get him till the Return of the King. And his role in that way will be kind of similar. And that will be a fun point of comparison, actually, right? Thinking about the role of Farmer Cotton at the end compared to the role of Farmer Maggot here and the role that he plays in this particular moment. But I agree. He's the other, the Cottons are, I think, the other family that are sort of most stereotypical, most mainline of all the hobbits. So let's keep going. It seemed plain that the farmer would tell them more if allowed to do it in his own time and fashion. So they all accepted the invitation. What about the dogs? Asked Frodo anxiously. The farmer laughed. They won't harm you, not unless I tell them to. Here, grip, fang, heel, he cried. Heel, wolf. To the relief of Frodo and Sam, the dogs walked away and let them go free. Pippin introduced the other two to the farmer. Mr. Frodo Baggins, he said. You may not remember him, but he used to live at Brandy Hall. At the name Baggins, the farmer started and gave Frodo a sharp glance. For a moment, Frodo thought that the memory of stolen mushrooms had been aroused and that the dogs would be told to see him off. Right? Frodo's, again, he can't help it. Right? He's got this picture of Farmer Maggot. Farmer Maggot, the ogre of his childhood. Right? And as soon as he sees Farmer Maggot start, right, he has his own interpretation. Milthaliel says poor Frodo has PTSD. Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But anyway, like he has like his own narrative, right? The world that he grew up in when he was a kid, in which Farmer Maggot was the big bad, right? And for a second, it looks like that narrative is returning, right? Oh my gosh, I have walked down the slot to a dragon's den, and now the dragon is going to eat me, right? So I see Mike's comment that he said when he was 12, he thought that Heel was one of the dogs. Yeah, it's an easy mistake to make. Grip, Fang, Heel. Yeah, it's, if he didn't repeat the command with Wolf, it would be even more confusing. But yeah, I can totally imagine as a kid making that mistake. I think the only thing that protected me from that mistake, Mike, was I had, before I read The Lord of the Rings, I had read a bunch of dog books, you know, like of the old Yeller genre, basically. So I'd already read about teaching dogs to heal. So I knew that was a thing. It was in the forefront of my mind. Anyway, so again, here's the narrative that Frodo has in mind, and it looks like it's coming true, right? That he really is in that world of his childhood imagination, that much smaller scale world, right? Farmer Maggot, not actually very dragonish, right? Some certain differences between him and a real dragon. But Farmer Maggot took him by the arm. "Well, if that isn't queerer than ever," he exclaimed. "Mr. Baggins, is it? Come inside. We must have a talk." Of course, he's thinking about something entirely different. And you notice the urgency of his hospitality. He will be revealing in a couple minutes that he did recognize Frodo's name and perfectly well remembers beating him and seeing him off his land before, right? But despite that, he doesn't even have a pause, right? He doesn't even, there's not even a flinch in his mind. Farmer Maggot already has a wider view of things, right? And Jonas Gloss is saying it shows how close their escape really was. Yes, I suspect the come inside has a little bit of urgency to it, right? Whoa, come in and get, in case he does return, I don't want him to see ya, right? Yeah, I absolutely do get that too, that his urgency of to usher them inside is actually for his own protection too. I agree, Milthaliel, there is a certain amount of realism here, as she says, how Frodo's childhood experience looms much larger to him, than it does for the adult farmer who is chasing off a naughty kid. And Milthaliel doubtless did it every weekend, right? Darn buckling teenagers coming over here and trying to steal my mushrooms. doubtless. But again, especially in the context, remember, just post-conversation with Gildor, right? One of the things that Gildor invites Frodo to do in that part of the conversations we've alluded to so many times about, you know, not being able to fence the world, it's not your Shire, right? I never expected to meet them in our own Shire, says Frodo, right? And Gildor's like, dude, it's not your own Shire, right? You need to change your perspective. You need to change the way you look at things. You're fooling yourself if you think that this is your Shire and that you're safe here, right? That nobody can get you here. You can't fence the world out. Hobbits are deluding themselves in thinking of the Shire as just their world, right? He needs to broaden his perspective. His perspective is still not, and we see and his a flash here, right, of his narrow childhood perspective, right? That world in which Farmer Maggot loomed so large. And Farmer Maggot immediately undermines it, right? The dragon, you know, takes him by the arm and bids him come inside for his own safety, right? It's a really anticlimactic dragon confrontation here. But again, of course, we've seen Frodo's world expanding already, right? Just in this last chapter, we've seen Frodo's world expanding in some really scary ways, right? And that's why this sort of flashback to his childhood fear of Farmer Maggot is such an interesting sort of piece of perspective for me, right? That really emphasizes how much Frodo's world has already changed and how much it's beginning to change, right? The way in which he now, how silly this looks, right? As soon as Farmer Maggot takes him by the arm and says, come inside, we must have a talk, the whole thing just dissolves, right? That whole fantasy, right, that he'd been retaining since his child, you know, that which is kind of a fantasy world, right, in which Farmer Maggot is the, you know, the ogre who bites the heads off of children, or rather has his dog bite the heads off of children, then probably eats them for dinner at home. You know, that world just dissolves right away, right? And again, what makes it happen? The intervention of the outside world, right? Something much worse than an ogre, something kind of even worse than a dragon, maybe a little bit less apocalyptic in its intervention in the Shire, but still pretty bad, right? Namely, a Black Rider's intervention has totally changed that world and made it just vanish, right? Yeah, Oakwig says it's like the elves recognizing the non-coincidence of the meeting of the hobbits right after they see the Black Rider. Yes, Gildor realizes in this meeting there is more than chance, right? Farmer Maggot doesn't have that kind of perspective, right? He's not like, I see, it might be my destiny to assist you in your journey, right? That's obviously not Farmer Maggot's train of thought. But clearly, any other issues that might be going on, I kind of wonder. For me, a sort of a fun thought experiment. What would Farmer Maggot have done? How would Farmer Maggot have greeted them had the Black Rider not come, right? Had the three of them shown up and Farmer Maggot had no clue, right? Hadn't encountered a Black Rider and is just, he meets, you know, Master Pippin, and Master Pippin introduces Frodo and Sam. And how would Farmer Maggot have acted towards Frodo, right? My theory, by the way, is that Brunier says Heel would have eaten Frodo. No. My theory is that he would have given him a hard time. I think he would have teased him, right? My theory is I think that Farmer Maggot would have pretended to be outraged and made it look like he was going to set his dogs on him, and then he would have laughed and been like, I'm just giving you a hard time, right? I totally think that he would have put Frodo on. That seems like a kind of thing that Farmer Maggot would do. It seems like a very Hobbit kind of thing to do. Again, given the exchange between Pippin and Farmer Maggot, I think that that's kind of, you know, he seems to be that kind of guy. That's totally what I would expect Farmer Maggot to have done. But obviously, he's not going there, right? Nothing like that's going to be happening since he is, you know, things have been very recontextualized. All right, well, let's stop there for tonight. It's field trip time. We're gonna go on our field trip, and of course, our field trip tonight is going to be to Bam Furlong. We're going to go see Farmer Maggot's place and what they did with Farmer Maggot's farm in the game. So we're gonna do that next time. My goal is we're gonna finish chapter 4 next week. Next week we're gonna finish chapter 4. I want to get all the way to Buckleberry Ferry and see how the relationship with Farmer Maggot unfolds, and looking at especially the way that this chapter ends, which I think is really neat. Again, chapter 4, pretty short. I think we're going to do it in 3 weeks. Yeah. We'll do an average of full 3 pages a day, you know, a class, basically. I don't really know, Raven King, what Bam Furlong means. I mean, I know what furlong means, right? A furlong is an eighth of a mile. It's a traditional unit of measure. But I don't know the prefix Bam. I don't know what to make of Bam. It sounds like it's one of those things which is, you know, like the way that place names are often built out of, like, sort of bastardizations of other kinds of words. So it probably, there was probably another word, wasn't actually BAM, B-A-M, but another word that sounded like that, that would be, that could be applied to Furlong, and it became BAM Furlong over time. It's a small village in the UK. Well, exactly. But the question is, where does that name come from? Tolkien loved this, by the way. He absolutely adored English place names and the derivations of English place names. He could talk about all the names of the towns and stuff around him. I mean, for those of you who have read Farmer Giles of Ham, one of his children's stories, one of his Tolkien short stories, like the whole premise of Farmer Giles of Ham started, was inspired by the name of a town, a couple towns in Oxfordshire. He absolutely loved that. So I'm sure Tolkien would be able to explain it, but I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer, but I'm sure that JJ is incorrect. Okay. Anyway, so we're gonna head out. So we're gonna go to Mickle Delving again. We're gonna gallop across the Shire another time. Tony said BAM means beans, maybe. Okay, I mean, that would make sense. They could grow beans there. I could. That sounds like a kind of thing that could happen. Okay. All right. Anyway, so let's. Let's take the stable master over to Mickle Delving, and from Mickle Delving, I want to ride straight to. If you don't meet up with me in Mickle Delving, I want to ride straight to Stock. So let's go to Stock. And we'll go down into the Marish from Stock, because I want to see how they present the land. Okay, so if anybody needs assistance in travel, I think that Lily Rose here can help you travel. But I'm just going to take the stable. So if you guys want to come out with me out to the stable master, and we'll ride out to. Back to the Shire, and then out to Stock. We will not go into the Golden Perch, because you know, if we go into the Golden Perch, we'll be there all night. So we will try to resist the allure of the best beer of the East Farthing, and we will we'll head down to the Marish from Stock. All right. So, let's see. There are a few interesting things about Farmer Maggot's place in the Shire that I'm looking forward to looking at with you guys. All right, out to Mickle Delving again. I see people in the Twitch chat are telling me not to be so hasty with Chapter 3. Well, you know, remember, hey, when we were doing Chapter 1, I thought 3 weeks was a lot, right? And Chapter 4 is legitimately short. It's only like 10 pages long. Okay. I won't take a horse from here. We can just ride from here. Sorry, we got some people coming in, right? Got some horses appearing here in the foreground. We'll just saddle up. Got my Eastamnet steed here. We'll wait for a few more people to arrive. All right. Good old Anfast Tunnelly. Of course, you'll remember that they will meet some Tunnellies in Bree, and Tunnelly is one of the names that they meet in Lee in Bree, which the Shire hobbits consider natural names, right? Like Sandheaver and Tunnelly. The botanical names are weird. Appledore and Thistlewood and Butterbur. They don't have names, you know, surnames like that in the Shire, but Tunnelly is one of the normal names. So I like the fact that the stable master here in Mickle Delving is named Tunnelly. All right. Let's head out towards Stock.
So we're just going to be going straight down the East Road again. As we have done many times before. Let's see, what time of day is it here in the Shire? Oh, it's dusk. Oh, nice, we're going to get a nice sunset here. We're already getting a nice sunset. The sky is all pink and lovely. And I'm running off the road because it's what you do when you're looking at the sky while riding a horse. Okay. Matthew says he's guessing that we're going to be taking 3 months in the Council of Elrond. Yeah, it's going to take a while. I mean, if you think about it, if I average about 3 classes per every 10 pages, then yeah, it's going to be a while in the Council of Elrond. Council of Elrond's like 50, 60 pages. So, yeah, doing the math, we're looking at like 50 to 20 weeks, something like that. We'll see. But yeah, there'll be plenty to talk about. Plenty to talk about the Council of Elrond. All right, so we're coming over the... Oopsie. I'm turning myself. I gotta use the other one. There we go. Now I can keep riding in a more or less straight line while I'm looking off to the side. Okay. Aurorian says... Aurorian. Like Tolkien, we'll spend a year by Balin's tomb. Maybe. We'll see if we can get to there in a year. It's true, actually, that would be a really interesting sort of test, right? Which is going to take longer? For Tolkien to write The Lord of the Rings or for us to discuss it? I'm not sure. Oh, yes. Thank you, Dime. Dime says I should point out, and she's absolutely right. Notice how the ring around my mini-map is blue here, right? Because we're in the Shire. And hope is high in the Shire. You're very low. So notice, we're at a hope rating of 3, right? Hope has been kindled within me because I'm in the Shire, right? When you're in the Shire, hope is kindled within you, right? So notice you get... an advantage to your maximum morale, you know, your health, your hit points, and a bonus to your damage dealt. Right, you're full of spirit when you are full of hope. So why is it blue? Like why the color blue for hope, Baron? Oh well, that's traditional. Blue has been the color of hope since the Middle Ages. That's long established. I don't know. Maybe they probably knew that, but I think it's at least sort of fortuitous. Hope's always blue. Whenever you meet, an allegorical figure named Hope in a, medieval allegory, for instance, she's almost always wearing blue, right? That's what you do when you're Hope. If you're charity, right? If you're love, you wear red, right? It's what you do, unless you're topless. But that's only in the Fairy Queen. Spencer was a little bit odd. Love, charity is topless in Hello. Spencer because she's always breastfeeding. She's very fertile. She got kids. It's like infants, children hanging over her everywhere. So she's in a constant state of breastfeeding her young ones. Anyway, sorry. All right, so here we are in the village of Stock. Let me get back on my horse here. The enticements of the Golden Perch are right in through there, right? That's the courtyard. We're not going to go in through the gate, though. You can see the sign. And notice, thinking back of what we wrote before, notice what you don't need to be in order to read the road signs and find out where the Golden Perch is. Literate, right? That's why pub signs in England still have pictures on them, right? Because you don't need to be literate in order to find out where the golden perch is. It's the one with the golden perch on the sign. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Okay. So here we are at the golden perch. So this is the village of Stock, and you'll notice even in the village here, it's agricultural, right? We got fields out behind the houses and stuff, right? We're not, these aren't like townhouses necessarily. The land slopes down. So we look, there's the river right there. Right across the way, that's Brandy Hall, right? We can see Brandy Hall, a regular warren by all accounts, right? You can see all, even from here and from this angle, which is not a great angle, on Brandy Hall, we can see all the windows and doors and gates and things all complex over there, right? And there's those Brandy Bucks. Look at that. It looks like they're having some kind of party over, some kind of carnival or whatever, big old tent there and some kind of booths and things over there. Those Bucklanders. Right, probably going to get all liquored up and come over here and try to steal our mushrooms or something like that. So there's Buckland Rudder, and then the land falls, right, and becomes wet. Now, the one thing that I find a little bit disappointing about the depiction of the Marish here in the Shire is that there's no causeway, right? So the road is really just a road and not a causeway. We do get wetlands, right? Like you can see how marshy the land is down here. It's not a swamp exactly. It's not like the Frogmores, right? If you go around Frogmorton, that's more, completely swampy. But it's wet. You could see how if you wanted to make a road through land like this, you'd need a causeway, right? You can't just be like, well, let's pave this puppy, right? No, you can't do that. Put down as many cobblestones as you like. It's not going to do any good, right, when you're standing knee-deep in the water. So if you want to have a road across land like this, you've got to pile up dirt, right? You've got to build a foundation and raise the road up above the level of the water, and ideally above the level that the water gets to when it rains a lot, so that the road can be up on the causeway, which is why not only are you going to meet everybody that passes on the road because there's nowhere else to be that's dry? But also people are going to be able to see you from a mile, from, you know, a long ways away, right? Because there you are traveling on the causeway, you know, like 6 feet up above the level of all the land around you, which is not only wet, but also very flat. So I do think that the land here in the Marish, they've gotten really well. Notice there's mushrooms, there's wild mushrooms everywhere. The Marish is full of mushrooms. It kind of makes you wonder why anybody would break into Farmer Maggot's farm to steal mushrooms when the mushrooms are this abundant. You could see why they'd come over here for mushrooms and trespass, right? Does he lay claim to every mushroom over here so that, like, you know, if you just come over here and start picking mushrooms, you're on his land and trespassing and taking his own personal mushrooms by default? Maybe. Notice this is a better view of Brandy Hall from here, right? That's the ferry right there, by the way. So here, this is not part of it, right? This is an Arnorian ruin, right? We got these all over the place. You'll notice we just passed the Stock Tower, right? This is one of these big old watchtowers. We can see the ruins of another one. We looked at this before, didn't we? We can see the ruin of the other one up here. Again, I really like the Arnorian ruins in the Shire. One of the things to me that it really emphasizes is, again, the extent of the extent of the shelteredness, sort of the inward lookingness of the Shire, that they don't, to me, it really kind of sets off that idea. Again, Tolkien doesn't mention anything about Arnorian ruins in the Shire, but it kind of makes sense. They would certainly be in Bree. We know they would be in Bree because we were told that the Dúnedain lived right in and around Bree. So clearly the ruins that we see that we're going to see together in the Bree lands, there would totally have been ruins there. They don't mention ruins in the Shire specifically, but although, again, we do get the standing stone, like this, remember the sudden tree or the standing stone in the Walking Song? You know, so maybe we do get some ruins you might come across and discover in the middle of the bushes, right, somewhere. Anyway, so that over there is one of those Arnorian ruins. This is not a Hobbit construction. I love the little tower, right? There's a tower. Look how queer folks are over there in Buckland, right? They are so weird. They build towers on top of hills. I mean, who does that, right? If they eat dinner up there, they have to throw the dishes out the window afterwards. Sorry. Inside joke from Return of the Shadow. But anyhow, bingo and
Well, the hobbits, whose names were totally different at the time, but the group of hobbits in Chapter 3, going into the Marish, had this long debate about having houses versus holes and having upstairs, and how they would just, if they ate dinner upstairs, they would just throw the dirty dishes out the window. It was a hilarious conversation, but a little bit odd under the circumstances. Anyway, like, they had just been dodging black riders, and they barely interrupted their conversation about throwing dishes out the window. Yeah, JJ says it's perhaps the text that he's most disappointed didn't make it into the published text. Yeah, what, the part about throwing dishes out the window specifically? Yeah, I bet. Anyway, so this is Buckleberry Ferry. There's no ferry here. This bounder here tells us that I'm sure the black riders that caused all that trouble in Buckland are to blame for this ferry mischief. Yeah, the ferry's messed up, right? The ferry is out of commission here in the game, but you can see this is where the ferry would have been. Probably, was it rowed or was it drawn? Well, we'll have to see when we get there. But it's close enough that they could just draw it on ropes back and forth rather than rowing it back and forth. I think it's probably drawn by ropes so it doesn't go downstream. But anyway, so this is where the ferry would be, and you can see the ferry is the main right there is the main approach right there to Brandy Hall. Again, I always think of that line from the party, right? A regular Warren by all accounts. And it does. I agree with you. It's looks like a great place for fishing. You can just see the bridge, right? There's the Brandywine Bridge up to the north. Doesn't look quite as far around, right? It looks like it only take the Black Riders just a little bit of time to get up across and back down. But again, scale issue, right, with the game. Anyway, okay, so let's go back over now, because we're not going to Buckland quite yet. That would be rash. We have to finish Chapter 4 first, so let's carry on down the road. And in addition to all the mushrooms that we are still seeing, you'll notice we've got a big old granary here, right? Like a storage silo, which suggests the, I don't know if I want to say wealth, that might not be quite fair, but certainly suggests the fruitfulness. There we go. A Farmer Maggot's farm. Now, one thing I want to draw your attention to. So here's Farmer Maggot's fields, right? Look at the, I really like how they've set this up in the game. So this is the road, right? This is the road that comes down from Stock. This is the main approach to Farmer Maggot's house. In other words, this is where Farmer Maggot expected them to come. And you remember the first thing he says to them when he meets them, right? He's like, I didn't see you. Okay, so let's look at that passage again. It's again right here, right? We didn't get to that passage. Sorry, we'll look at that next time, where he says that they passed down his lane without him seeing them, right? And he's kind of saying, like, I know you came over my fields, because I would have seen you if you came down the lane. So the way they have it, this is the lane to Farmer Maggot's house, and it's completely exposed. Look how, if you follow the road like you're supposed to, look how long of a warning Farmer Maggot has before you get there, right? He's like, okay, I see you coming. I saw you coming down the hill, and now you're coming up around the corner. And now he's got his eyes on you the whole way, right? Until you come in. This is the front entrance. And I love Farmer Maggot's house, right? Nice house. I think they do Farmer Maggot's house really wonderfully. Look how it's, I think it's an excellent combination. On the one hand, this is a nice house, a big house. Nice hobbit door, painted a very attractive purple, I would add. Windows, this big light window up here, right? Oh, this is, does he have a second story? Maybe he has a second story. Anyway, very airy and roomy if it doesn't have a top story, right? So it's not huge. This isn't a mansion. This isn't house of the great. It's a farmhouse, right? But it's a very nice, solid, comfortable farmhouse. We're told, of course, that people in the Marish went in for houses. The ground is way too wet to dig holes here, right? So you see, not only does he have a house above the ground, but he has this whole raised stone foundation, right? Because Farmer Maggot doesn't want, or rather, I presume, Mrs. Maggot especially doesn't want, you know, the floors all flooded with water all the time. And if we look around the back, we can see, I love the thatched roof, right? Not an expensive slate roof, but not a turf roof either, right? This is high quality, spacious, but peasant house, right? So this is where they would have been. They would have been having this conversation with Farmer Maggot right here at his gate, right at the entrance, where the lane enters into his house. Remember, Pippin says, "Let's get back onto the lane, and then we shan't be trespassing." They had gotten too far to the south and had to veer north back towards the. So they came. You can't really get there in the game because this is all. This is we're at the southern edge. Again, if we look at here, this line of hills here represents where the map ends, right, in the game world. So you can't really come all the way up from the south. You can't get any further south than this. But they came up from the south across his fields and then got into the lane quick so that they won't be trespassing, and they came in as if they had come by the road the way they were meant to in the first place. Bem Furlong is also expansive. We've got a stable here, bunches of outbuildings, right? Where we've got those barrels. I don't know what you keep. What's in the barrels? Hang on, I gotta dismount here. Not the closed barrels. What's in these barrels? Why are they under here? Oh, aha! See what it is? Pipeweed, I'll wager. Gotta be. Yeah. Barrels of pipeweed. Okay. Probably somewhere in the drying process, I would imagine. What do we have over here? What do we have over here? It's, what is this, meat being cured or salted? Smoked, maybe? That hook there suggests this is probably meat? I don't know. The green looks a little odd. Something's being treated here. I suppose it could be. Lady Gum thinks this is drying pipeweed too. This is another stage in the pipeweed process. That's possible. Why some is green and some is brown? Yeah. No, that's a good theory. I thought it might be meat, but no, that's not going to be meat. You're right, that's probably pipeweed too. So we see him drying pipeweed in several stages. We got this drying out here and then being put in the barrels over here. Okay, all right. Got the whole production. There's his chickens, right? Okay, got some poultry going on. What's over here? Ah, now we're getting like the root vegetables, right? Those are probably turnips, maybe taters in there, right? Oh, look at them. We've got artichokes and radishes. What is that? What is that? Leeks? Probably leeks. Sacks of potatoes, right? The pots of honey, maybe up there. I bet. Does he have bees? I didn't see any bees, but maybe he's got bees. Maybe he trades for honey. Could do, right? So notice how diversified his farm is, right? He's growing his own. So, you know, they have Bem Furlong is this almost completely self-sustaining place, right? They've grown their own vegetables. They grow their own pipeweed. They've got chickens. They've got sheep, right? So they've got wool. Notice they don't have a big flock of sheep. Probably don't raise the sheep for meat. I mean, they only seem to have the two sheep, at least only the two here. But that would be enough for wool, right? So if you're raising the sheep for fiber. And then, of course, over here we have the mushroom houses, right? So we got these little burlap greenhouses going on where they grow the real prized mushrooms. And I'm thinking this is totally, if you're a Brandy Hall teenager, this is where you're going, right? You know, like those, all those mushrooms out there,
I mean, just around, go, all you got to do is go around the corner, right? What do you see? Mushrooms right there over the fence, right? Everywhere outside his land, mushrooms as far as the eye can see. But no, if you're a buckling teenager, right, you're totally wanting to steal the big prize, right? You're gonna sneak in here. Look at those puppies. Would you just look, right? So here's Kaylada or Kaylava. Do you pronounce it with a double D? Anyway, there's Kaylada, right? The she's human. I think she's human, right? Look at this. These are knee high to a human being. These mushrooms. Look how big they are, and for a hobbit, right? Let's see, who's this? Ooh. I don't know how to pronounce your name. But anyway, if you look at this hobbit last next to them, it's like thigh high on a hobbit, these mushrooms. The caps of these mushrooms are bigger than her head. So, I mean, right, you're a hobbit, you're living nearby here, this is where you're coming, into his special greenhouses, right? Well, sort of greenhouses. Anyway, but because of course you want to grow mushrooms in a shady place. You don't want the light on the mushrooms. So you create the shade just to do that. Hang on, we didn't inspect this outbuilding over here. What's he got over here? Oh, it's stable, right? He's got his horses over there, of course. Of course. And over here now, of course, we haven't met Farmer Maggot himself or his dogs. Now Wolf is his biggest dog. Is that Wolf asleep over there? That's Fang. That's Wolf who was walking around, right? Yeah, that's Wolf. He's doing the rounds. Yeah, there he comes. So this is Grip, and there's Fang sleeping. And here is Farmer Maggot himself. Now let's look at Farmer Maggot. Okay, he is, you know, his clothes are, you know, he's plain, but his jacket seems to be a pretty good quality. Notice he's got his jacket is done up with frogs, not with buttons. He doesn't have buttons. Remember the brass buttons on Bilbo's waistcoat that he was very proud of, and how at the end of the book he's upgraded to gold buttons on his waistcoat, right? Farmer Maggot doesn't have buttons on his waistcoat. He's not so posh as that. He's got frogs. You know, he's got the you can see them there on his coat. But there's decorations on his collar, right? And he's got a nice undershirt there. Workaday pants, but a nice shiny belt buckle, right? I like it. And his title, Respected Farmer, right? And this is his son, right? Hammy Maggot. That's a great name. Of course, it's hard to have a good first name. I mean, any first name you have is going to be kind of undermined by your last name, Maggot. It's really hard to do that. But Mithalio, you are absolutely right. The dogs are absolutely enormous, right? I mean, look at especially to a hobbit. I mean, you know, you have one of the hobbits come over and stand right next to a Grip over here, right? I mean, there it is. Look at that. The dog is higher than the hobbits, right? Enormous Mythologist says, no wonder Frodo was terrified. These are definitely ferocious dogs designed to be able to kill things, to kill major, you know, if there are any predators that come in, any wolves that come in, they're probably wolfhounds, right? He wouldn't keep hounds like foxhounds or something like that. Not Farmer Maggot. Something like wolfhounds, right? So when he says he keeps ferocious dogs, it's not just, you know, these aren't like poodles with a bad temperament, right? These are. I love their treatment of the dogs. I think it's it really captures things very well. Yeah. So imagine being young Frodo, chased all the way from here to the ferry, by those dogs. So anyway, I really like the fact that the way that things are set up in the game world. Oh, hang on, did I hit that stupid
target toggle again. Okay. Okay. Sorry. I hate it when I accidentally hit that command. All right. I love the way that the game world has it set up. Again, you can see how he would be able to see anybody coming. Again, from his vantage point where he's standing here, there's the road, right? You can see, I can see you coming all the way down from stock and turning the corner down the lane and come right. And he's got all kinds of time to mosey around the corner of the house and meet you out in front if he sees you coming. But of course, it's totally tempting to trespass, right? I mean, no matter what direction you come to Farmer Maggot from, you know, it's always like the most direct way to go right across his fields. Yeah, it's funny. Gravity's saying he's surprised there isn't Dread standing this close to the dogs, right? It would be hilarious if hobbits got Dread in Farmer Maggot's farmyard. I think that would be awesome. Anyway, yeah. Okay. that would be cool. Anyway, okay. So the other observation that I would make about Farmer Maggot's farm, you know, about Bem Furlong in the game, it's the only one like in the entire Marish. Again, it's a scale thing, right? There are no other farmers. There are no other farms in the Marish. It's just this one, right? So you clearly get the idea Farmer Maggot's an important person. Right. He is the representative farmer. And that, again, to me is really fascinating because I think that, you know, in the book, Farmer Maggot is a real representative. Right. I mean, in meeting Farmer Maggot, and we'll look at this a little bit more next week when we see the rest of their exchange and the meal that they share with them and stuff. Their time with Farmer Maggot, it's one of the only times we're ever going to see that slice of normal hobbit life. Right. Farmer Maggot really is kind of a, you know, a representative in that way. And he is the sole representative of Marish farming here in the game, which again, I think is kind of fun. All right. Well, I should let you go. We're late now, even though we started late. So thanks very much, everybody. Next week we'll be back normal time. I think we're on Landreval next week. I'm missing, Trish couldn't be here today, so I'm totally lost without her. That's why I started late too, by the way, because I didn't have Trish. And so I'm like trying to figure out how to turn people's mics on and stuff. You know, I can figure out my own stuff, but I'm kind of helpless. So, anyway, and so I don't remember. I don't have Trish here to remind me of which server we're doing next. There is a calendar, though. I should mention this. Again, if you go to the discussion board, if you go to lotro.mythgard.org, and you click on calendar as one of the options, and so we do try to keep that updated as we set the schedule at least a few weeks in advance, and you can there see if you want some warning about when we're going to shift to a Europe-friendly week. You should be able to see that coming for a few weeks in advance. But we're going to be at 9:30 for the rest of May. The calendar says TBD through most of June, but I think we're going to be on Landreval next week is what I seem to remember. But we'll send out a correction of that if I turn out to be wrong. So anyway, thanks very much, everybody, for joining me today. Thanks for everybody for coming who came to Bem Furlong with me here tonight. And I look forward to our finishing up of chapter 4 next week. So thanks very much. Good to see you all again, and I'll see you again next week. Bye now.